those away walls I behold. Hello, goodbye, been here under check sky. The anthem of the Republic waves for those who gave their lives for grace. Help them sing a song strong and new. Let the voices sing through you. It's true. What you were born to do. From the mother's Red Sea, we fight like pirates at the Boston Tea. Come and join us in our revelry. We'll sing to set the city free. The plastic people of the universe are here. Let them sing on. Without fear, it's clear. You know it changes here. The Velvet Revolution. The Velvet Revolution. The Velvet Revolution. A war of words and melody. This ancient song will cross. Sad, solemn soliloquy to change the face of celebrity. The Velvet Revolution. The Velvet Revolution. The Velvet Revolution.
You're listening to KHENLP 106.9, Salida, Colorado. And this is Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLPFM radio, a community-supported radio. We're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And tonight, my co-host is Katie O'Brien, and we've got two very special guests, and I do have a DJ in training too, is William Wallace here sitting, and as far as our guests tonight, we have Ron McDonald and Robert Rowan. And Ron is a Vietnam veteran who spent the last 25 years studying law. His key interests are fundamental principles and inherent rights from which all other law arises. He's watched in dismay as unalienable rights have been reduced to mere privileges. His overriding interest is for fellow citizens to be free of government tyranny. Robert Rowan, MD, is a PhD, a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Johns Hopkins University and UCF Medical School. He's devoted to educating readers of his Second Opinion newsletter on the real causes and remedies of illness. Boy, I'm not reading good tonight, but hint, not deficiency of drugs, by the way. So in his 26 years in the field, he has watched in dismay while the forces of toxic medicine have organized through government to destroy is superior competition biological healing. His overriding interest is freedom of medical regulatory tyranny, and over the last 6 years, friendship and countless hours of discussions, these two interests mutually interacted to uncover the one common denominator related to the loss of all freedoms. And this is because they've written the book, they own it all, including you. And this book proves in simple, easy language that we're living in a matrix. Behind a fraudulent and corrupt monetary system and lies the hidden creditor. This book proves that this creditor is actually the puppeteer of an insolvent government and hidden master of all American citizens and courts. The creditor has deviously devised a monetary system based on exchange of debt owned and or leaned by the creditor. As one may not see one specific tree in the forest, one does not see a hidden mark lean on every transaction he makes until that specific mark is actually pointed out. Then it becomes visible for all time. They own it all proves that we all have become subject to a devious scheme for our daily transaction. The book reveals the common denominator for the economic implosion, loss of inalienable rights, rise of government tyranny, and how the servant government became the master, though itself serving a well-hidden higher master. By making the invisible, toxic, and leaned currency visible, the reader is empowered to remedy a collapsing society with solid steps to create a new world order of the people, not the government and its hidden puppeteers. Ron and Robert, are you there? And
yes,
Katie?
I'm here. This is Ron.
And I'm here, too.
Okay, and Katie?
I'm here.
Okay, great. And William?
This is William Wallace, and I just want to honor your works, Ron and Robert. This is the theme of my heart. I can't wait to see what you have to bring us tonight.
We hope we don't disappoint you.
Okay, so I'll let one of you get started and kind of tell us how you got into this project.
Well, I'll start and Ron will finish. That's how we often handle our interviews. I'm an alternative medical doctor, and my philosophy of medicine is look for the cause. The current paradigm in medicine is treat the symptom, disease maintenance. It works for the system. And guys like me tend to lose their licenses or get thrown in jail. I have some colleagues in jail right now who didn't hurt anybody. And I could never understand how somebody who is actually healing another human being at no risk and there's no complaints could end up in jail or losing his livelihood. In Alaska in 1990, I got the nation's first bill passed protecting alternative medicine, which spread to many other states. And then I moved to California in about 9 years ago, and I met Ron. And with Ron's help, because of other things, I came to see what the common denominator is in the loss of my rights and your rights to the health care of your choice, to the loss of all of our freedoms, and it's through the currency. And Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I got into this about 30 years ago, if not a little longer. And what had happened, I was approached by a gentleman, an acquaintance, that said, "Don't you feel something's wrong, Ron?" And I didn't quite understand what he was talking about. And he says, "Don't you feel the pressure and stuff like that?" And then I thought about it, and I observed society at that point, and I realized there's not one thing we can do in society that isn't regulated. We can't travel without regulations. We need to be licensed. We can't add on to our house. We need to have a permit. Everything required permission from the state. And I started looking at life differently. I said, if I were to put pressure on me for everything I had to get permission for, I would basically be under a weight so vast that I could barely move on my own or in my own freedom. And that's when I decided to get involved and research law and find out what caused all this. Because we're taught as children that we have freedoms here in America. And yet, the freedoms are elusive. We don't have those freedoms. We're regulated. And that's how I got into this aspect of the law. to bring forward the book with Robert. Let's put it that way.
Okay, so...
So you started collaborating in like 2001?
About, what was it? I'd say about 2004, Robert?
2003, I think we got together for the first time. And we've spent probably a thousands of hours on the telephone together discussing this. And much of this information was Ron's. And I guess I was just the catalyst to formulate it into a book and to put a couple other dots together to nail it. And what we think is a single common denominator. I mean, I wish medicine was so easy. When you come to me with a problem, there could be 15 or 20 different causes for your problem. And I assure you, it's not a deficiency of drugs. But what's going on in this country today? I believe, Ron, correct me if I'm wrong, that 99% of the problems is the currency.
Yes, if not 100% of the problem.
Well, tell us about the toxic currency.
Well, perhaps we should begin with a little treatise on the history of the government.
Okay.
Ron, is that all right with you?
Yeah, go for it, Robert.
Okay.
Hey, can I say one thing before we get started? The views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Cahan staff, volunteers, or board of directors. I just have to say that as protocol, but everything I'm sure you guys are telling us about is the truth, and we don't have to worry about it being opinion.
Well, see, isn't that part of what we're talking about, toxic currency? Freedom of thought and expression is limited now to violations of law that one could be held liable for, even if he doesn't know he's done anything wrong. And that's what we're talking about tonight as far as what the toxic currency has done to a free nation. Okay, Robert, I'm sorry to...
that's okay. Well, once upon a time, when this nation was founded, the people were sovereigns, literally kings. Our rights, in the conception of the United States, is that rights come from the Creator. And they come from the Creator through the common law of the land. The common law of the land is actually not even written. Or in a sense it is, but it's not. It comes forth from the law of Moses. And basically it's you have unalienable rights that cannot be taken from you, to do anything you want to do so long as you don't tread on the rights of anyone else. You can't lie, or let's say you can't bear false witness. You can't rape, pillage, murder, steal, etc. You have injured another person or his property. That's the essence of the common law. And also in the common law, when you make an exchange for something, let's say you were going to buy my cow, you give me something that is yours for something that is mine. And what is yours would be usually gold or silver coin that's yours, and the cow is mine. And when you put that in my hand, the cow then becomes yours. That's called payment and extinguishment, and it's a common law transaction. Well, we had common law in this country, and the nation and the Constitution were founded on the common law. And that is even memorialized, our rights are memorialized in a case called Chisholm versus Georgia, where the Supreme Court said at the time of the Revolution, the sovereignty of the king devolved upon the people. They became sovereigns without subjects, except for the African slaves, which at that time were a property. We're not commenting on slavery at this point, we're just commenting on the law as it stood. So the people were literally kings without subjects. You had your sovereign property over there, I had mine over here, and our rights to each other were one king to another. And that's how we were dealing with the government. And the federal government was not involved in our lives. We were not party to the Constitution. There's a case called Barron versus Baltimore that specifically spells out that the so-called Bill of Rights, the First Eight Amendments, do not extend to the people of the states. Their rights are protected by their state. Their rights come from the Creator and are protected by the state, not by the central government. Now, the slaves, on the other hand, were more problematic. At the time of the Civil War, they were property. The North won the war, and they got captured property of war. The slaves were in commerce. And the North could have done the right thing by the slaves and placed them within the status of the common law, where they had unalienable rights that come from the Creator. But the North played a trick, and it bamboozled the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment simply says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to its jurisdiction, two qualifiers here, are citizens of the United States. So these people were born in the United States. They were persons, not necessarily people. And they were subject to the jurisdiction because they were captured property of war. And they were given a legal status called citizens of the United States. Heretofore, we had been citizens of our states, not citizens of a corporation called the United States.
Can you explain the difference between persons and people?
Go ahead, Ron.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Can you explain the difference between person and people?
Well, person is a status of an individual. If you look at your century-old dictionaries, it will tell you that it is a veil placed on top of a man. For example, in our contemporary society, we have many veils. One's called a taxpayer. A taxpayer is a person who pays a tax. A driver is a person who has to be licensed. These are all veils on top of a real flesh and blood man. The term people, however, as used in, and I'm going to say in the federal constitution where we have the preamble, I first want to qualify that. Patrick Henry actually was very upset with that use of that phrase in the preamble to the constitution. He said to those writing the constitution, how dare you use people in the preamble? They are not party to this federal constitution. This had more to do with the states than with the people. But people refer to a nation as a whole. And when this country was first created, people were bloodlines. And that's, and we have cases that prove that when the country first was done, first was created, there were no citizens, basically. That was by consent only. And I'll get the case for you if you're interested in that. Let's see if I can't find it quickly. Citizenship. Republica versus Chapman. It says, employing a doctrine stated most clearly in Pennsylvania case of Republica versus Chapman, it's a 1781 case, American courts came to hold that citizenship must originate in an act of individual consent. That meant when you're over here in the United States, you didn't even have to consent to being a citizen. So what happened from then to here right now? And that's basically what we're talking about in the book on the toxic currency.
Okay.
So let's move on a little bit. You're finding out that a person in law could be a corporation, could be a limited liability company. It's something with a facade, a persona, whereas a man and a woman don't have a persona. They are creatures of God with unalienable rights. You with me on that?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, slaves were persons. They had a persona. They were property. And then they were given a status of a citizen of a corporation. And at that time, the United States, and it still is a corporation. And that can be found in a case, One Marsh. And you can go to Bouvier's Law Dictionary, see United States, and it will give you the site and tell you that the United States are a corporation.
Now, would states have been incorporated at that time?
No, the states themselves were meets and bounds. And I'll give you an example. They would actually say Massachusetts state. They wouldn't say the state of. The state of is a prepositional phrase that means it's only a part of something. When they say the state of California, that's the corporate California. When they say California state, that's the actual meets and bounds. You're talking landmass.
Okay, but were they incorporated from the beginning?
No, they were not.
Okay.
The only thing incorporated was, and you'll see that in paragraph 5 under the United States in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, as Robert said, was this concept known as the federal government. United States of America.
Okay. Sorry to interrupt, but it
Oh, no, please
No,
do.
Please ask questions.
Okay.
Because we want people to understand this fully.
Okay.
So the United States, in law, was a corporation. The slaves now got status called a citizen of the United States, meaning they were citizens of a corporation. And the 14th Amendment went on and gave them privileges and immunities. 14th Amendment doesn't say rights. No state shall abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States. So where do their privileges and immunities come from? They come from the corporation called the United States. They're not unalienable rights that come from God. See this a subtle difference?
Yes, and how would a Native American been treated under that if they'd come under treaty in that sort?
They actually were treated as sovereigns. They okay. had sovereign tribal land, and that's still the case today.
Okay.
What happened next?
Okay. It wasn't enough for them to have property. Oh, the fourth clause of the 14th Amendment says that the public debt of the United States shall not be questioned, which means that now if you were a citizen subject of the United States, and another term for subject is property. If you were a citizen property of the United States, you couldn't question the debt of the United States. And the United States was in debt following the war. The bankers saw to that. Well, it wasn't enough for them to have the former African slaves as property. They had to figure out a way to rope the rest of us into the same status. So we can fast forward now to 1933, and then we'll backtrack a little bit because this is how we did it in the book. And we want to remind your listeners that the name of the book is They Own It All, Including You. And the subtitle is By Means of Toxic Currency. And they could go to our website, www.newpeopleorder.com. Instead of New World Order, New People Order. So, we're going to fast forward now to 1933. And remember, until 33, there was gold coin in the hands of the people. And silver. But we're mainly interested in gold. Gold was the money of sovereigns. Silver was the money of the people. In 1933, President Roosevelt stole, and I'm using that word, stole, theft, crime, the gold of the people. Can I be any clearer?
I think that's pretty clear.
Okay. He held them up at gunpoint. In other words, and I'll prove it to you, in the book there's a picture of a $20 gold certificate. And it says, this is to certify that there is deposited in the Treasury of the United States of America $20 in gold coin payable to the bearer on demand. So let's say you're at a hotel and you give your bag to the porter at the hotel, and he gives you a claim check for your bag. Whose bag is that?
Katie?
It would be my bag.
That's correct. Why? Because you hold the claim check. It's your bag. He's holding it for you in trust. Now, suppose you come back and you give him the claim check and he says, get lost. Screw you. We don't want you. You're not getting it back. What just happened?
I've been robbed.
Correct. Well, I know people who have a gold certificate and a silver certificate, and they can't get their gold with their claim check, that certificate. So what happened to those people?
They were robbed.
They were robbed. Theft by the alleged government. I can't be any clearer than that. And their gold was stolen. And the next day, they were given pieces of paper called Federal Reserve Notes. Ron now will explain the calamity that befell us when we lost our wealth and we could no longer pay a debt.
First, the thing that the listener needs to understand is the different qualities of currency, which is your Federal Reserve note, versus your lawful tender, or that gold coin that we once used as, which actually is money, but we once used it here in the United States. With it, with all species and all uniform commercial notes, and that Federal Reserve note is a uniform commercial note, there are intrinsic qualities, built-in qualities in those things. In the gold coin, there's an infinite number of qualities in it. It has specifically, the most important qualities are title, rights, and interests are actually in that. So when you hold a gold coin in your pocket, it's yours by title, rights, and interests, absolutely. That means you hold the highest level of ownership in that gold coin. There's something else in that gold coin also. It's an artificial quality embedded in that coin. It's called lawful tender. And that falls under our Constitution, the power of Congress under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5, to coin money. Now, money means gold or silver. Their power to coin the money made it lawful. And they did that under what they wrote into an act called the Mint Act of 1792. And that dealt with specifically lawful tender, or the shape, the grains of gold, precious metals, and everything else within that gold coin. So it had not only the seal of the state of the United States on it, it was the only lawful coin allowed for transactions here in the United States as far as the United States money system was concerned. It was the money of accounts. So let's take that gold coin and let's buy a automobile with it today, and if that automobile cost $10,000 and we had $10,000 worth of those gold coins, all the qualities of that gold, those gold coins, would transfer into that car. And what I mean by that is you would now acquire title, rights, and interest in the car. You would own it absolutely, and the only way it could be taken from you is under common law due process. That means even the state could not remove it from a highway without taking you into the courtroom and proving that you did not have the right to that car at that point. Now let's go and jump over to the Federal Reserve note, the fiat money that was passed into law when the gold was taken or stolen, as Robert had stated. The fiat money has a quality in it, but it doesn't have anything backing it. It's known under Title 12, Section 411, under the federal codes, as obligations of the United States. That means they owe, every time they borrow one of these Federal Reserve notes, they owe the creditor for that Federal Reserve note, or the denomination on it. So they borrowed a $10 Federal Reserve note, they owe the creditor $10 on that Federal Reserve note. But there's a hidden lien in there. We prove that under a case that we discovered, and that case is 3,000. Let me get to it. I didn't know I was going to be thrown into this show. $3,976.62 in currency, one 1960 Ford station wagon. And this is the United States versus that $3,000-something dollars and the 1960 Ford station wagon. This was seized on the land here in the United States. And this is what the case, what I quote from the case. It says, although presumably for the purposes of obtaining jurisdiction, actions for forfeiture under internal revenue laws is commenced as proceeding in admiralty. After jurisdiction is obtained, proceeding takes on character of a civil action at law. So you can see in this that the Internal Revenue Service seized property on the land, also seized currency on the land, and it did it in the jurisdiction called Admiralty. Now, what is Admiralty? Admiralty is contract on the high seas in a time of war. Why is this case, why are seizures and forfeitures starting in a jurisdiction out at sea? You have to question. Now, it deals with that money that we're talking about, the Federal Reserve note, and what that Federal Reserve note pays for. Now, let's go back to the example of the gold coin where the qualities transfer in. into the very thing you transact for? Well, the same thing happens with a Federal Reserve note. There's a hidden lien on there. And that hidden lien transfers into the very thing you purchase. So if you were to buy a $10,000 car with $10,000 of Federal Reserve note, the creditor's lien, that would be the interest the creditor has in that car, would be 100% or $10,000. The lien passes through. Since the Federal Reserve note has nothing backing it, it has absolutely no value to it, to you or I. It doesn't pay off anything. And as I said previously, it is obligation of the United States.
So you just bought something with somebody else's money, so it's now there.
Well, you just got something with someone else's IOU.
Okay.
It's not their money. It's their IOU.
Okay.
Ron, perhaps let me interrupt you for a moment. A Federal Reserve note is defined at Title 12, Section 411 of the United States Code as an obligation of the United States. In other words, it's a debt. And who is the debt to? The maker, the master, is at the top. Federal Reserve System. The obligor, or the one who owes it, is the United States of America. So you're giving a debt of the United States of America to the Federal Reserve, Bank for your car.
So if we were to go back to 1933, and let's say the day before the fiat money was law in this country, let's say a man had purchased his house for $10,000 of gold lawful money under the enumerated power of Congress under that Mint Act, which has never been repealed, that Mint Act of 1792. He had value in his house. He also had title rights and interest in his house. No one could touch his house. It was under common law principles. Okay, the day after, when fiat money came in, all the gold was taken, the coins and the certificates were taken from that man. He was now given a fiat money that the value of his house was based on. Do you recall what I said the value of the Federal Reserve note was? Was there anything backing it?
No.
Absolutely not. So what was the value of his house?
Zero.
Zero. But what was the lien on his house when he paid, when his house was worth $10,000 Federal Reserve notes?
$10,000.
Yes, right to the creditor. That's the swindle. Without one shot being fired under a ballpoint pen or maybe an ink pen, the president stole the entire wealth of the American people on that day. Everything in this society was now valued by a worthless fiat currency. You see that type of contract that we got ourselves into? It stole everything we had. Now, let me ask you a question. When you labor, you're actually producing your property. That's energy exerted. It's your life force and everything. Do you believe it's an unconscionable contract to give across the board your labor for worthless instruments on the other side of the contract?
No.
It's unconscionable. It steals your labor. You can never attain wealth if your labor is stolen right there. And the only means to acquire wealth is through labor. I don't care if you're the Bilderbergs. I don't care if you're the Rothschilds. Labor is the only means by which any man acquires wealth in society. So right at that point there, right at the very minimum point where you labor, your wealth is stolen. Do you see what has happened here in America?
Yes.
Okay, now, when you're saying this, then so, and if somebody has investments or things of that sort, or own a business of that sort, is that, how does that get negated in this process?
Well, it's an illusion. Everything, the life's blood of a society, is its currency or its money system. The life's blood of the United States and every nation around the globe is a currency that has no value to it, yet has hidden liens on it, and is owed to a creditor.
So, to
answer your question, it's an illusion that it's your business, first of all. It's an illusion that you're part of, that you're building what you believe is your wealth. The only thing that makes the illusion plausible to any human being is possession of these things at the time. But as we'll talk about a little later, possession guarantees you no rights in ownership of anything.
Okay, so if they're using the dollar as a standard around the world, then are they doing the same to everybody else in the world?
Yes, and you can go on Wikiup, and it'll say, if you research gold standard, you'll see that no government today has any of its currency backed by any precious metals. They're all just fiat monies, unbacked, and obligations of a creditor.
So if they're stockpiling gold or anything of that sort, then they're just kind of rat-holing it, and nobody else is getting any credit of it. Is that
when you say they're stockpiling gold? Are you talking
I mean,
about
like the leadership or the whoever.
The creditors are usually doing that.
Okay.
And the thing is that there's been a two side of a fence on whether the United States is in bankruptcy or whether it is not in bankruptcy. If it actually went in bankruptcy in 1933, the defining of bankruptcy is one. A man or a woman or an entity cannot pay its liabilities, and that means it is on the negative aspect of the merchant's account. That means if it has a $10,000 bill out there and it's $1,000 in debt, it is called insolvent, and whether it declares bankruptcy or not, it is in bankruptcy. The United States has how many $1 trillion in the national debt? Does it have the gold to back it up? No. It is insolvent. It is in bankruptcy, declared or not.
If you can't pay me what you owe me, you are insolvent. You're bankrupt. You don't have to go to court to acknowledge it. You're bankrupt. Now, in 1933, when the nation would not honor my gold certificate, when the federal government, the corporate federal government, would not honor my gold certificate, it was bankrupt. So we have a bankrupt nation. If it's bankrupt, then it's in the hands of an unseen creditor, because they didn't tell us this, but it's bankrupt. So who is pulling the strings here? It's the creditor that's pulling the strings. And what they did was they stole the wealth of the American people, the gold, our ability to pay debt, and they gave us their privately owned property known as Federal Reserve Notes. There is no difference from this than the slaves on the plantation who were given script by their master to do their exchanges. The script was owned by the master. It was debt currency, and they could exchange for their daily lives. When you go to buy your car, you haven't purchased it. You don't own the clothes on your back. You gave masses script. And for the privilege of using masses script, which is an article in international commerce, remember, the Federal Reserve Bank is a privately owned corporation, which we show in the book, offshore. It's not incorporated in the United States. So you're dealing with international commodity in international commerce, and for the privilege of doing importing and exporting this international privately owned commodity, you're subject to excise tax, also known as income tax, for your daily transactions in importing and exporting, buying and selling this international commodity.
So this is how you get around the arguments often heard by some of these men arguing for against the IRS and their legality of being able to collect taxes, because in what you've literally explained is that they are legal in their terms. Is that, am I saying that?
Totally legal. The income tax, we believe, is 100% constitutional, 100% legal, because you're dealing with importing and exporting a foreign commodity, so there can legitimately be a constitutional excise tax. And Ron actually uncovered that in the Bruchhaber decision, We have, even though it's legal and constitutional, there's a constructive fraud by fraudulent concealment because no one knows that this property that's in their wallet and purse doesn't really belong to them. Ron, tell them what you found in Bruce Schaber and the impact of that.
Yeah, it was it actually was the first case and basically the only case that deals with the Income Tax Act passed in 1913. It's called Bruce Schaber versus Union Pacific Railroad. It's, for those who are legal astute, it's 240 U.S. 1. And it's a 1916 case, and it's used today for anyone who wants to say that the income tax is illegal. And it's most important to understand that the words used in the determination of the case are balanced words. No word can be used with ambiguity because it would throw the case out eventually if someone were to come across. What I mean by ambiguity is if the case is determined and it's confusing to the reasonable man to interpret the case or to read it clearly what it means. Now, in that case, Judge White, Chief Justice White, said the following, and I quote, "The appellate filed his bill to enjoin the corporation," and enjoin in that sense means command the corporation from complying with the income tax provision of the Tariff Act of October 3rd, 1913. Now, you may have missed what he said there, but I'm going to emphasize the word tariff. Tariff is an excise tax. It's on imports and exports. And Chief Justice White just declared that the income tax was a tariff on imports, exports. Well, how do we get on imports and exports? Well, Robert kind of stated it, and when he stated that the Federal Reserve Bank is a foreign corporation to the states. It is chartered in the United States, but it's foreign. It's a foreign corporation.
And where are they located?
Robert, do you know the specific address?
We don't really know. We've been trying to find it. And even G. Edward Griffin, who wrote the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, he really couldn't tell us either. But I investigated every state in the country, every state that has a Federal Reserve Bank in it, including California and Washington, D.C., and nowhere is it listed as a corporation that was chartered here by the respective secretaries of state of the states.
So on this excise tax, because I heard that that's how the United States supported itself, was on excise taxes up until that point of the Federal Reserve. Is that correct?
That's the only way it does support itself, and that's called revenue. And we'll get into a case what revenue means. It's important to understand, and I saw on the History Channel about the Federal Reserve, there was a documentary about 4 years ago, and something that stuck with me was the term that they used, and they called these Federal Reserve notes. They said it was their product. Now, that means a lot when you're bringing it forward to what has happened to us today.
Okay, now, but didn't they, when they created this Federal Reserve Act, then essentially they just stole our ability to have an income, correct?
Whoa. They put us in income.
Yes. You didn't have an income prior to
the
Federal Reserve Act.
Okay.
And it's not the Federal Reserve Act that actually made the income to you. Now, understand, an income as defined in the Internal Revenue Codes is not the Federal Reserve note. It's activity.
Okay.
It's an activity. So the key question is, what activity are you in? Now, we already stated that, I'm going to probably state clearly that all constitutions within every state was created with common law language. Common law came with a creator on top, man on the bottom, and man's servants and his government under him. That was common law. The common law language was the language of the land. And that's why you hear common law is the law of the land. It arises from the land. We get our unalienable rights attached to the land, but they come from the creator to us. And you know they arise from the land because as soon as you leave the shores of the United States and go to a foreign country, you fall under the laws of their land, no longer under the laws of the United States. So let's see, how did we get from there to admiralty? And that's the jurisdiction we're going to talk about. Admiralty, again, is the law, is contract on the high seas in a time of war. its component is maritime, which is contract on the high seas in a time of peace. So we're talking about contract. Now, what is the contract that creates us into income, income taxes, and things of that nature? As we said clearly, the Federal Reserve note is a product, but it is a foreign product. Most Americans think of the Federal Reserve, or currency, of the United States as belonging to them. Does it really belong to the American people? You can't leave with 10,000 of them without declaring them when you leave the country. You cannot pay your property taxes with $10,000 without raising suspicion and having to fill out an income or IRS form. You can't. There's so many things you can't do with that. You can't deposit $10,000 of cash into your bank without having to fill out a form. So are they really yours? Well, no, they're not. If they were, you would have absolute ownership of it, and they wouldn't. They couldn't tell you what, how, or how many of them you can leave the country with, or what you could use, the amount you can use to pay off anything. That would be your business and not their business.
How does the Uniform Commercial Code fit into this, then?
Uniform Commercial Code is the jurisdiction upon which all negotiable instruments arise. Anything that represents something, even your gold certificates, they represent the gold that's in the mint or in the treasury. They are under the Uniform Commercial Codes. So representation falls in commerce or the commercial codes. So your dollar bills, your Federal Reserve note, that's all currency. It represents something. In this matter, it represents the obligation of the United States. But still, it represents something. Did that answer the question?
No. Okay.
May I ask a question here?
Yeah, Wallace.
William,
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Does the representation also include private notes between people? Can I just give you a receipt for my car? You take the car?
Absolutely. Even your attorney, it represents. He's in commerce. Anything that represents is in commerce. But it's not, in that respect, it's not under the Uniform Commercial Codes. It's paper that I'm talking about as far as that. So, yes, anything, your private promissory notes, anything written on paper that represents is a commercial instrument.
And that can be on land or sea or in war?
It's usually not on land. If it's on, you know, we're basically, when we're talking about commercial instruments, we're talking about the law of the sea. All commercial instruments fall under the law of the sea. It's as old as Babylon.
Okay.
So are we currently under maritime law?
We're currently under admiralty law.
Admiralty,
we have
okay.
At the helm the commander-in-chief. The only time the phrase commander-in-chief is used to represent the president is that when we're at a time of war. Otherwise, he's considered a citizen out of the populace. You ever hear of the president being called the commander-in-chief?
Yes, but I've never heard him being called the other.
Yeah, he's not a citizen in office. He's not doing managerial work right now. He's commanding the armed forces. So we're in admiralty right now.
So, and you know you're in admiralty one other way. Ron already told you that all Internal Revenue collections commence in admiralty. What are they collecting? They're collecting the privately owned property of the Federal Reserve Bank. When you walk into a court, you'll see a gold fringe flag, which is a commercial flag. And what are they collecting in court? They're collecting international commercial property. And in the book, we point out the following, and I'm going to give Ron credit for this.
Is that the only thing, Robert? Or more than that?
In the court?
No, in the book.
No, the credit.
I don't give you... I love you, Ron. You know, if you walk in, if you're blindfolded and you are taken into a court and the medium of exchange is the peso, what country are you in?
Mexico.
Okay, and if it's the ruble, what country are you in?
Russia.
Right. Now, let's say you're blindfolded and you're hauled into a court and the coin that, or the money that's used is a gold coin that says United States of America on the back of it. Whose court are you in?
And pre pre-1933 coins.
Yes.
You had felt those with your fingertips. That's how you know.
Now, you see that the coin is dated, we'll say, 1910. Whose court are you in?
That was
the United States.
You're in the court of the United States. And you can see that in the Coinage Act of 1792, where the next to the last provision of it says that the money of accounts of the United States is the dollar, cent, and mill according to the Act, which means a fixed weight of gold and silver coin. You with me so far?
Yes.
That is a court of the United States. Well, in 1933, when they stole the gold from the people, when they stole your property and compelled you into peonage, forever peonage, they didn't have a court of the United States for you anymore, so they had to create a mirror image. Now, what happens if you walk into a court and the medium of exchange that they're working with says Federal Reserve note at the top? Whose court is it?
It's a foreign court.
Bless you. Go to the head of the class. Now you know whose court you're in.
So what took place?
We've discussed that these Federal Reserve notes are foreign product. If you were to switch out every Federal Reserve note in the system of America today and replace it with a Japanese yen, do you think the people of America would be very upset and hostile and recognize that they were under the jurisdiction of the Japanese at that point?
I hope so. I hope so, too. Upset.
Well, we're under the jurisdiction of the Federal Reserve Bank, aren't we? It's their product.
Okay, but what took place in 1913 to enable them to take over our monetary system?
Specifically, greed. The Congress was offered a strategy to give it unlimited credit. Now, what's the nature of the beast? And when I talk about the beast, humanity, is it to get unlimited wealth if it can? Isn't that within all of us to get most everything we can in life? That's the nature of the beast. Well, when you have a group of men and women who decide that with unlimited credit, I could do a lot of spending, do you think they would favor a Federal Reserve or deny the existence or prevent the existence of a Federal Reserve Act from happening?
I think they'd jump in with both feet.
Yes, they would. Yes, they would. And did they have anyone in control of it? When you realize that in 1913, I know my grandparents were working 15-hour days. My grandmother had 15 children. She wasn't into politics at that time. My grandfather was working in a coal yard that he owned. He was just trying to feed the children, and I have no doubt that was the way it was at that time.
But there were people like Lindbergh that tried to point out that they had just kind of sold their souls, essentially.
Yes.
How could we have stopped it at that time with people just trying to survive?
Well, we couldn't stop it at that time because we didn't. I mean, prior to the change of the century, there were very few educated people in America. That only came after the fact that education actually came in. I think, in the 20s, 30s at the best, it really started flourishing here in the United States. But prior to that, who would have known this was happening behind the scenes, and who would have paid attention to it? At the dawn of this country, most families carried a Blackstone commentary with their Bible. They understood the law, and they understood their rights. They understood what unalienable rights were. Freedom was, get off my land. This is my house, my castle. And the next thing you would hear would be a fire over your head, right? A shot over your head. Today, all that's taken away from us. And that's one of the aspects of having Federal Reserve notes in. We've lost our common law rights under a creator. They've been replaced with privileges and immunities, and we've been regulated, and we don't have those rights. And that's why you had to say at the start of the program, these are the views of the individuals and not the views of, because if you're in common law, you could say anything you wish to another human being, providing you don't play one finger on him, you had not broken the law.
Interesting, because I've never seen it put in that fashion.
That was Patrick Henry that said that.
So, boy, there's so much in what you're saying here that for a lot of people to be able to even digest in all of this.
So I probably should move to that one point that we're going to, and the imports, exports, and how that was done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we said we were in common law, but they stole our money. They stole our money, and what I mean by money, our gold and our silver eventually, and they replaced it with debt instruments. At that point, those debt instruments fell under the Admiralty jurisdiction. That put us into international law. When we're using that, we're in international law. Now, the key point here to really wake up and recognize is that Federal Reserve note is a foreign product. Now, it's not the Federal Reserve note that's taxed. It's the activity that's taxed. Well, you, when you take your labor and you cash your labor in at the end of the day or the week or the month for Federal Reserve notes, you are importing. That's an activity. Foreign product into your house. When you pay your PG&E, your mortgage, and all your bills, you are exporting that foreign product. That's an excise. That's revenue.
But that wouldn't have been deemed that prior to when?
Oh, well, we didn't have that currency prior to 1913.
Okay. So you wouldn't have been charged those taxes.
Yeah, and you notice we didn't have an income tax prior to 1913 that was substantiated and proven constitutional. We did have one before that in 1890-something that was proven unconstitutional. But this one was based on a foreign product,
okay,
foreign negotiable instruments.
Now, would they have had property taxes back prior to that then?
Well, property taxes actually were never to be allowed on the lands of the United States. All land was held in public trust. It was held under land patent. And land patent meant that the land itself could never be liened. There could never be anything veiled on top of the land. And that was because over in England, the land was stolen from the people, left and right. It was stolen. Here they didn't want the same thing happening. They didn't want bankers coming in and leaning properties. It could never be used as security because that's where a man went and hide, where he went and raised his family, where he went to survive, where he went to plant his food. That was his safe harbor.
So
what is your safe harbor today?
So could they have used anything to as collateral then if they couldn't use their property?
No, they couldn't. They could use other things as collateral, but they couldn't use land.
Okay.
So they could use your horse, they could use your tools, they could use whatever, but they could not use your land for obvious reasons. Would you want your elderly parents to be thrown out of their houses because they couldn't afford their property taxes?
No, but I wouldn't want it today, but it looks like that could easily happen.
Yes. You see the wisdom in leaving a man's land alone? Isn't that a blessing from God? I mean, that's what it's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we ever attach the very thing that we call our home, raise our children, go to survive in? When we're ill, we stay there. How would you like to be thrown out of your house where you're ill? And yet that's happening across the country, isn't it?
Right. And let me stop here just a second and say this is KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And this is Truth Quest with Melody. And this evening, I've got Katie O'Brien as a co-host, and I've got a DJ in training, William Wallace. And our guests this evening are Robert Rowan and Ron McDonald, who have written the book, They Own It All, Including You. And we're having quite a lively, very informative discussion on what's included in their book.
I would like to add that the co-title is By Means of Toxic Currency.
And let me elaborate on that term, toxic. If you recall what Ron said, there is a hidden lien on this currency. And I'll try to put it in a better term. Let's say there's a car. I have a car. And I didn't pay it off. There's a lien on it. And I give you the car for whatever reason. We do an exchange. And I didn't tell you that there was a lien on that car. Can the creditor come and get that car?
Yeah.
Of course he can.
Today's laws.
Of course he can. The creditor can come and get that car. You don't own it. There's a lien on that car. The car belongs to him. I had it by privilege. Now you have it by privilege, and if the terms aren't met, the creditor's going to come and take it. Now, if the $10,001 that you are trying to take out of the country were yours, would you have to tell the government about it? No. It's yours. If the $10 million that's stuffed in your mattress that you've paid taxes on were yours after you paid taxes on it, and you wanted to give it to your children as an inheritance after you've paid taxes on it, would the government have a say? No. So you get to pay another transfer tax for transferring the possession of their property to someone else, and that's called an inheritance tax.
See, it's an activity, isn't it? And that's what's taxable, is the activity, not the money, but the activity.
And I'm a medical doctor, and maybe I'm using their property. Don't they have the right to set the terms and conditions of my use of their property? In other words, mandating that I get a license so that I can exchange my God-given talents for their property? Are you getting the picture now?
Right. Now, they didn't always do that. It's kind of like you're noticing them doing it more and more and more. What made them lay off of not doing that, you know, across the board from the beginning?
Prior, in the common law, there was no licenses for the common man. The only one that was licensed back then would be a criminal. If he violated the law, then he would have to be licensed. And you'll see that in the early marriage license. The marriage license was basically two people who were violating the law of the land at that time, and that was considered a mixed marriage. So if you had commingling of the races and you wanted to be married, you would need a license because that was considered to be unlawful at that time. Now, prior to 1933, prior to 1913, prior to the Interstate Commerce Clause, a man's talents came from God, and you couldn't regulate that talent with a license because then you would be saying you were regulating the power of God in that matter. But today, it's the state that says we own the occupations, we own the doctorship, the contractorship, we own the attorneyship, we own all these things, and since they're ours, we will regulate them, and they no longer belong to the Creator.
Okay, but you're also saying that the state is owned, I mean, it's in all realities owned by the foreign government.
That's what we're saying.
Okay.
You notice that your courts, what type of negotiable instrument do they deal in? All Federal Reserve notes. How do the officers of your state get paid? Federal Reserve notes. How does the Congress of the United States get paid? Federal Reserve notes. There's a hidden lien on all those. For their services, they get paid Federal Reserve notes, and the lien goes across, doesn't it? Same thing when you give birth to your child. You have to pay the doctor. And when you pay the doctor, the lien has to go on what? The activity. And that's giving birth and to the baby. The lien just follows it straight across. The lien goes on everything. There's not a piece of land, not a product, not a service that doesn't have a lien on it that's been used by any toxic currency throughout the globe. And all of them are toxic. All of them have liens on it, not just in the United States. This isn't isolated to the United States. It's a global takeover of the wealth of the people of the world. And that's what's happened.
In other words, all of the people, it's not just us, but we can explain it best in terms of the Federal Reserve note. because the people are familiar with the history of the country to some degree, and that we had gold and silver coin at one time. But this is an international takeover by the international bankers of all of humanity into the status of peons.
Okay, and when you're saying there's a lien on everything else, then you're also saying there's a lien on the people then.
That's right.
So if your child is born, it's not really yours.
That's correct.
Okay.
And this is like a real elaborate company store where people used to owe their souls to the company store.
Can I ask a question here? Is this lien on anything and everything because of an activity exists only if the federal notes are used?
But Ron, he's asking, is it because we're using Federal Reserve notes? If you're using a Federal Reserve note, they own it. Now, I'm going to give you some proof. This is in the book, and this should make your jaw drop. And it's because we knew of these events that we were able to connect all the dots and fully encircle what we term the beast. Now, the beast that we're referring to is spelled B-E-A $T. We're not talking about a supernatural creature. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm.
And we're terming the mark of the beast, B-E-A $T, as the invisible lien that's carried, that's his mark, that's on that note. I'm going to prove it to you by telling you this. In the book, we have a hard copy, or a photostatic copy, of a letter that came from the California Franchise Tax Board, which is the IRS of California, to a man where they alleged he owed an income tax. So he said, fine, I don't think I owe an income tax, but I'm going to actually pay you with real money. He sent them a $5 gold coin dated about 1880. Real money. They sent the coin back immediately, not quite immediately, about 6 weeks later, and they told the man, you submitted an invalid financial document to us for the tax year. We're returning the enclosed document to you. It's invalid. So of real money, a $5 real money gold coin, weighed and branded by the lawful United States under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5, cannot be seen by the state. And we'll get to the reason in a moment. Now, we'll doubly confirm that the court, a federal district court, took a man to task. The IRS was trying to reduce a tax assessment to judgment, which is a slam dunk. Only takes a couple hours to do. Well, this man is the first person that we know of since 1933 to lodge real money, a $5 gold coin, pre-1933, into the court for payment and extinguishment of the alleged debt. The United States government didn't respond, and they had an absolute duty to respond, because if they don't respond, then they've acquiesced. Oh, this couldn't happen, though. The judge figured out a clever way to get out of this. And in a little footnote at the end of the case, he admonished the defendant for not telling the court what monetary value, if any, the gold coin had. In other words, the man didn't give anything. That's how they were able to get out of it. And at the same time that he says that the man owes a lot of money, the judge tells the court clerk to return his gold coin.
Can I interject, Robert?
Please.
Yeah. The thing about that gold coin, as we said earlier, the Mint Act under which that coin was minted has not been repealed. The enumerated power of Congress under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5 to coin that coin, coin the gold into coin, has not been repealed. The lawfulness of that coin still exists. The money of accounts of the United States is still the dollar, the mill, and the cent. That coin is as lawful today as it was when it was first minted. Now, the court could not recognize that coin having any value. It was absolutely foreign to that court.
Well, that was what I was going to say. So in other words, it's like trying to exchange a foreign dollar for, or a foreign currency for ours, and without going through some medium of exchange. Is that, am I following?
Right.
Okay.
So that's it. That's the point. If they cannot recognize the lawful money of the United States of America, what court, whose court is it?
Then
it's the people's court?
No.
No.
That's the point. The same thing with the franchise tax board. They could not recognize the lawful coin. And we have a government code here in California that stipulates that the money of accounts of this state under 6852 of the government, 6850 of the government code is the dollar, the mil, and the cent, the lawful coin of the United States. And they couldn't recognize the lawful coin. Are they a lawful government?
They couldn't be.
No, they couldn't be. So who's at the helm of the United States of America, and who is at the helm of the states of the Union?
The Federal Reserve.
That's right, the Federal Reserve.
You're on the sea, in ocean, where you're in commerce, where there's no common law, there's no law, and you're dealing with commercial admiralty law. We have been lifted off the land from which our unalienable rights flow. Rights come from the land, and we have been placed swimming in the ocean.
So you'd understand, you know, we're talking about income tax, we're talking about that coin being used to pay a tax. I want to define what revenue is. There was a case in 1840 called the Huntress. It's a federal case. For those who student law again, it's 12 Fed case number 984 at page 992 and 989. And it says, and I quote, "In this country," meaning the United States, "revenue causes had so long been the subject of admiralty cognizance that Congress considered them as civil causes of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction." What does that tell you?
That
all revenue is on the sea. It still is. So where are you when you're paying income tax, a property tax? They're all revenue laws.
So when you go into these courts, do you have any recourse?
Yeah, you do. What I'm gonna just throw a question out there. What they did to us, was it with our knowledge or without our knowledge?
Without.
That would be called fraudulent concealment, wouldn't it?
I would think
so. When they steal our labor, which is actually property, and there's many case laws that it is property, and give us an unconscionable return on it called debtor's instruments or obligations owed to a foreigner, is that criminal? Is that stealing?
I would say so.
That's criminal conversion. There are your two remedies right there. For those of legal expertise, they would know how to move forward on those two things. Fraudulent concealment, not telling us that, first of all, the Federal Reserve note is a foreign product. Secondly, it has a hidden lien. Thirdly, it's an obligation of the United States and has nothing backing it. Criminal conversion is that when you give property, no reasonable man would expect to get in return for the property he's given an obligation or the debt of another man in replace of it. That would be like your next-door neighbor saying, "Hey, I want to buy your house. I know it's up for sale for $30,000. I owe my credit card company $30,000. I'm going to pass that debt over to you. Be happy." That's what your government does to you every day through the Federal Reserve Bank. Does that sound like it's a good deal?
No.
See, and the nature of a contract, both parties must take equal risk in a contract. Otherwise, it's an unconscionable, tenable contract. It cannot be held a legitimate contract. Both parties must take equal risk. Where's the risk on the side of the Federal Reserve when it steals our labor and gives us nothing in return? No risk at all, huh?
No.
You see the fraud on the American people?
Yeah, I do. And And let me ask you something. Are you a practicing attorney now then?
No, I'm not a licensed attorney.
Oh, okay. All right.
And I don't give legal advice in accordance with the first precepts of this station.
Okay, well, I had to ask that because you don't usually hear
I've
this kind of...
I've never lost a case. Let's put it that way.
Well, with that kind of information, I wouldn't imagine a practicing attorney would be coming up with it. That's why I had to ask.
Well, I've done many cases, and Robert will tell you, I've done impossible cases. I've not lost one of them.
If we are an admiralty, how is that different than receivership?
Wait a second. Admiralty is the law of contract on the high seas in a time of emergency. That's not receivership. When you are insolvent and your creditor takes you over, you're in receivership. And we actually can prove this in the book because it's in the congressional record. Congressman James Traficant said on the record, gentlemen, we are herein now trustees of the greatest bankruptcy that's ever been known on the world, that of the United States.
So we're in receivership.
This nation is in receivership. And when you're in receivership, you are owned lock, stock, and barrel by your creditor. Just think about, what a scheme. They're stealing our labor and sending our children off to fight their wars.
And the thing is, it's perpetual.
We can't get out of it.
We can, but it's the way it's set up. It's for the sheep to be unaware of what's happening.
May I ask a question about contract law? As I understand, a contract is only valid if it is the terms are, one, known, two, understood, and three, agreed to without coercion. If we haven't known that there's a contract, we don't understand it, and it was rather coercively put upon us, is this contract really valid?
No, it isn't. It is not, and that's because of the nature of that fraudulent concealment.
So then we can just walk away from the Federal Reserve and tell them to go home and leave us alone.
If it were that easy, you would need a critical mass to start being knowledgeable of this here for that to happen. And believe me, if we hit a critical mass, that would happen. Absolutely.
And that's why we're hoping that you and your listeners will do everything you can to spread the word. Because when people read this book, they're just floored. I've had guys, I have a friend who's been in this field for years, and he has been fighting the beast for years, and he knew things. But he told me after he got to the middle of the book, because he knew the first part, he said, oh, my God, with every next chapter, he said, my jaw just dropped. I never connected the dots this way to see what was really going on.
Now I also want to bring up, and I don't know if your listeners have heard of the Larkin-Rose argument, the 861 argument,
no,
which is a very valid thing. It says that the only time you owe a tax is if it's from a foreign source of income. Now, we just explained to you what the foreign source of income is, haven't we?
Yes.
You're importing a foreign product and exporting it on a daily basis. When you leave it to your children at your demise, you've transferred it. That's an activity. And for the creditor says, well, if you're going to transfer my product, which I have complete ownership like copyright in or patent on, you have to pay an excise on it. So you see where all these arguments out there before saying, define income, define it as a foreign source of income, you know, the taxation, and it's not because I've made my money here in the United States. Well, here's the clue. You haven't made money here in the United States. You've imported the currency, which is a foreign product, which is not money. It is a commodity, and you're a merchant. And under international law, the United States doesn't have to tell you the law at that point. You're deemed to know it.
So Larkin Rose, who went to prison on his 861 argument, arguing that you can't tax me because I'm not involved in international commerce. I'm in the United States accepting the fruits of my labors. And he used this 861 argument, went to prison, as have other people. And his own 861 argument indicts him. Because when you read that section of the code, it tells you that if you are dealing with a foreign corporation, you're in commerce.
Okay, tell me this. When they first settled this country, this was all done through commercial ventures. And so did they just not recognize the Constitution?
Well, you know, the Constitution, let's be specific about the federal Constitution.
Okay.
It never was meant to apply to the citizenry, and why do we know that? First of all, each state had its own constitution. I told you they wrote that constitution in the common law language. That was the language of customs on land. And what they did in those constitutions, a constitution is divided in two subparts. The first subpart is called the Declarations of Rights. Those are not all our rights, but it says these are our rights. And the second subpart to it is called the Delegations of Powers. And the only way there can be a delegation of power, one has to go back to the Declarations of Rights and see that power there to be transferred over. Now, if you know about case law and delegations of powers, once delegated, it cannot be redelegated. Did we, in fact, vote for a federal constitution, or was that the state doing it at the time it was created? The people had no involvement in the federal constitution, and that was a redelegation of power from our representatives. Could they, in fact, give over, grant more power than we had given our original servants in our states?
So was that intentional, a sleight of hand on their part?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
But see, there was case law out there saying that the federal government was held to a square 10-mile area. It wasn't to penetrate the states, and that was well known there. And when it used the citizens of the United States, it was referring to the citizens within the several states. There was no such thing as a United States citizen at that time. We have case law to prove that. So we can see that the federal government or that constitution only had one side of the constitution, unlike what we have in our states. It had a delegation of powers, and it was the states themselves that delegated the powers. There were no declarations of rights in it. The Bill of Rights came afterwards, and as Robert stated earlier, we had a case called Barron versus Baltimore. And in that case, it clearly stipulated that the reason for that Bill of Rights was for the purpose of restraining the federal government from ever touching upon any of those rights. It had nothing to do with citizens of the state. And I also have a case in here from the Constitutional Law, Volume 92, Key 665, that says, a person may not sue for a breach of the federal constitution because he's never been made party to it. Not until the 14th Amendment you weren't.
Okay,
so
now,
prior to 1868, you were never part of the federal constitution.
So are you, in a sense, saying that if we reinstated our state constitutions and started acting upon them, it would nullify the federal one?
I'm saying we can hold our representatives and reinforce our common law constitution, take out all the commercial law, because being on the land, can you make commercial law? And all administrative law is commercial law. And administrative law is your DMV, your Commission on Aging, your medical boards, your franchise tax boards. That's all administrative law. That's a quasi-fourth branch of government built-in admiralty law. That's the whole purpose of it. It removes you from the court system of real law. So, if we were to enforce our common law language within our constitutions, the very supreme law given by the supreme lawgivers, which are you and I, if we were to reinforce that, no officer within the state could do anything unless he could trace his authority back to us. Well, now, they don't trace their authority back to us, do they?
No.
And that happened, and I'm going to give you just a little summation of that. Back in 1933, under the New Deal, Roosevelt started the National Industrial Recovery Act. what he did under that act is he declared that the people of the United States said that capitalism was a scourge on society, and he needed this act to take over unlimited powers granted by the Congress to the presidency to control the economy. That meant, in a group of very small hands, the entire economy of the United States from thenceforward would be controlled by a group of small people. That includes there will be licenses on everything, how to manufacture china, how to make a broomstick handle, how to do this or that. Everything will be regulated, so we don't have too many doctors. We'll make the test too difficult one year. If we need more doctors, we'll make it easier the next year. We will have farmers over-till crops in order to keep the economy in control by the central government.
So is that when they is that how they created statutory law, or was statutory law before that?
The statutory law actually was before that, but it didn't apply to the common law. All prior to the 20th century, all court cases were tried under maxims of common law. They had the principles of common law in them. So if you want to say they were statutes at that time, sure. But what happened after 1933 is the introduction of the commerce law. And you'll know this here different than our state laws. When the people formed their constitutions, they created three branches of government. In the federal, the states created the Congress, the executive branch, and the judicial branch. Three branches of government, each having enumerated powers distinct from either branch. None of them redelegated their powers in any of the branches. Same things within the states. You had the legislature, you had the judicial, and you have the executive branch. These were known as decentralized branches. What we mean by decentralized is that power was severed and separate, not replicated in any other branch. Now, what happened in 1933 was the creation of agency law or administrative law. And this is where the Congress, in its lack of wisdom, granted to the President of the United States unlimited powers. Well, I just got finished saying that the powers of Congress and the President and judicial branch were all enumerated and limited, restrained. So where did that excess power come from to grant to the President? It came from the judicial and from the Congress. It gave the President of the United States, up to that point, a vast, unknown before power of a dictator. Now, I'm going to read something.
But where did they get the ability to do that? I mean, because they were never given that capacity to work in that manner.
You got it. You just brought the question forward. That's what people should be asking. Where did they get the power to do that? They didn't have it. Now, here's what it says about enumeration of powers, and this comes from the Encyclopedia of America Constitution. And it says, the first sense of limited government refers to enumeration of powers through which the Constitution outlines the jurisdictional concerns of the national government. This method of limitation has failed. The enumeration of powers is now a dead letter as a result of the nationalizing tendency of American economic and social life, which the Supreme Court has accommodated through the interpretation of the Tenth Amendment, the Commerce Clause, the Necessary and Proper Clause, the General Welfare Clause, and on and on and on, Civil War members. There are no more enumerated powers under restraints. Do you get the point there? We have a tyrant in the White House. We have a tyrant in every state capital. They mimic and mirror each other. They have unlimited powers. There is no restraints on them. I'm going to go back to the Constitution, and it was Judge Urdell, and it's something that few people know, and hopefully I can find it quickly. Judge Urdell, he had been a member of the Federal Constitution for drafting the Constitution. He later became a judge of the Supreme Court of the United States. At the convention, the representatives were extremely concerned about the interpretation of the then Federal Constitution and wanted assurance that it would be an instrument strictly applied with enumerated powers and not implied powers before they ratified it. Judge Urdell, who helped draft the Constitution, made clear the nature of that Constitution. He stated, and I quote, it, the Constitution, may be considered as a great power of attorney, under which no power can be exercised but what is expressly given. Now, a power of attorney is a restraint and a limitation, isn't it?
Yes.
We were under a restrained compact with the federal government through the states. Today, we call that same instrument that was supposed to be restrained and limited a living instrument.
So in other words,
how did it get from there to here?
I don't know. How?
You see, this is fraud, encroachment, and it is a takeover of the rights of the American people. And all it takes is for knowledge. When the people become knowledgeable of these things, it's not the federal government we need to attack in any form. I don't care about the federal government. We need to hold our state representatives to the law of the land. That's the common law upon which the Creator is on above. We come second and they come third. Today, the state has replaced your Creator. It says, you will drive with a seatbelt on because we're protecting you. Don't worry about your Creator. We're protecting you. Put your helmet on. We're protecting you. You get a permit and we'll look at the house you're building.
And we're going to tell you what diseases you're allowed to have and the treatments you're allowed to have to treat the diseases you're allowed to have because we're going to protect you.
So if you've gotten the theme, it is a spiritual battle, isn't it?
Yeah.
Gentlemen, can I ask another question here? It sounds to me like all this fraud has the veil or illusion of real or substantial only as long as we acquiesce to it. My question is, if we were to just reject it, stop acquiescing and going like, oh, you made that law too? Okay, and just start saying, where is your authority? I'm the authority, you're not.
William, as you say, in critical mass,
is that going to stop it then? And
the thing is that the beast wants its pound of flesh on a daily basis. And the beast is the creator of the Federal Reserve note. And that's that note that is raised in the consciousness of all citizens across the globe. Until a citizen can realize and see clearly the reality versus the illusion, the real from the illusionary, the fantasy, until we can wake up and say, Federal Reserve notes are not money, they're currencies of debt. When I transact with them, I go deeper in debt and I'm in bondage because of them. It makes me property of whosoever product that is. Until we wake up and not be so subject to all the complications of this massive strategy, including what's the economy like, how much is the dollar worth today, what's the bank giving in interest, do you know the president's going to lend out another $1 trillion, bailout money. Until we get out of that illusion, because it's all illusion, we're going to succumb to this continuously.
Well, and it's also an illusion to even try to hold the Federal Reserve to an audit. I mean, we should just disband it.
That's it. And Robert mentioned the 14th Amendment. It says a citizen, cannot question the debt of the United States. If you audit the Federal Reserve as a citizen, one being paid by Federal Reserve notes, are you not questioning the debt of the United States when you audit it? You're asking the creditor to show its books, aren't you?
Yeah.
Right.
Isn't that questioning the debt?
Right.
We don't have that right as debtor. However, even though it was alluded to that this was a legal system, it's based in fraud, isn't it?
Right.
That will always be our remedy. And our fraud is, if your neighbor did the same thing to you, if he sold you a bill of goods and he told you that it had value to it and you found out he didn't even have the pink slip, say, to a car that he sold you, that's fraud, isn't it? You'd know how to handle that.
Right.
If he robbed you, if he broke into your house and stole your possessions, you'd know how to handle that. Well, we have the biggest crooks in the world coming into our country. And they're robbing us left and right. They're robbing us of our freedom, of our rights to our Creator, of every aspect of our property called our life substance to labor and appreciate and gain wealth in our lives. It's stopping us. Do you feel the pressure?
No, I've been on to this one myself. I just didn't come to it with such incredible dot connecting.
So you can say it's legal. It's legal in the commerce jurisdiction, but the means by which we have been roped in has been through fraudulent concealment. And that alone is the remedy. For once we hit a critical mass and the people realize that every day their property is stolen, that and their property is their substance that comes, where does it come from? Does it come from you, or does it come from an outside source that you don't even know? You come into this life with so many years of substance in you.
Okay, but we wouldn't have... You were talking about remedy before, but when you have entities that utilize even an admiralty court, it's all done on fraud, so why would we even bother with their court?
That's true. Although we still have a great right within the court, and I'm going to explain common law and commercial law, and then I hope Robert will get into the jury system. Would you do that, Robert?
Sure.
Okay. The common law. How do you identify the common law? In common law, in order to commit a crime, you would have to have an action plus a damage equal a crime. So if you took your car and you drove over your neighbor, you have an action, and let's say you killed your neighbor, you've committed a crime. Same thing if you stole your neighbor's lawnmower. You have an action going over there. Taking it is the action, and stealing it is pulling it away from your neighbor, his possession. That's equal to crime. But what about the commercial jurisdiction? And that's basically what we have today, is commercial jurisdiction. If you speed in a 25 miles an hour zone at 30 miles an hour, you've committed a crime. So you only have an action equaling a crime. Now, that's not under the law of the Creator, is it? The law of the Creator is very clear. Law of the Creator says you have to have a theft or an injury and an activity. You have to intentfully do it, and you have to cause that injury to equal a crime. That's the common law.
Okay, in other words, these were victimless crimes like speeding.
Victimless crimes, and it's a big business, isn't it?
Right.
You can be ticketed for jaywalking. You could be, my God, I mean, you could, let's say you have five kids, you don't have much money, but you're a carpenter, and you have a one-bedroom house and a wife, and you're a true believer in the Creator and everything else, and you say, I need another room, I'm going to build another room. You get red-tagged.
Right.
And you refuse, and you continue to build. Guess what?
You probably go to jail.
You go to jail. What crime did the man commit?
Nothing in the common law.
Nothing in the common law. He had a basic right to do that. But in the commerce law, he didn't. A victimless crime. Could he ever achieve wealth if he's constrained by the commercial jurisdiction? Common law would let him achieve wealth, wouldn't it? It would say that he could transfer his labor into his house and make a better house, and thereby achieve more wealth.
So are you saying that in remedy of sorts, should we sidestep the admiralty law and go to the common law?
Robert's going to get into that.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we have to get back into common law. And if you're exchanging with commercial notes, then you're in admiralty law on the sea. So... Let's look at the jury, for example. Ron asked me to comment on that. In the old days, when we really were in common law, the accused had the right to what's called plenary due process. In plenary due process, he got to tell the jury everything. He could tell the jury the story of his grandmother meeting his grandfather, if he felt that was relevant to his defense. The jury heard everything. Today, the judge filters what he wants the jury to hear. That's called procedural due process. You're not in the common law. Now, one of the remedies that is still very valuable that can be done in a heartbeat and would take our country back possibly in a couple days if we can disseminate the information in this book, hope you help us do it, is the jury. Because a big Achilles heel, even in the admiralty jurisdiction, is to condemn somebody, they need our help. They need a jury, even in their jurisdiction. So they come to us to condemn our fellow man as a criminal for a crime he didn't commit. All he did was an action and no one was injured. Now, I'm not saying that you should come to the defense of a rapist or a mugger or a murderer. I'm saying that if you have somebody who's accused of a regulatory crime where there was no other human being injured, no property injured, then all it takes is one person who is educated on the jury to throw the case. And when they can't get another conviction in this vulgar admiralty administrative jurisdiction, because people will just stand up and say, I'm not going to condemn someone else for a victimless crime, the whole system will crash like a house of cards.
Now, there are those that talk about using the grand, bringing the grand juries back. Is there a difference?
Ron, you want to comment on the grand jury?
Yeah, the grand jury is usually filled with the prominent people in your area. So, and they're usually, I'm not going to say they're crooked. I'm not going to say that they're pompous, and that's, you know.
But they bought into the whole game.
They bought into the whole game, is right. I mean, they're going to be the wealthiest people in your society, more than likely, the businessman. So that bringing back the grand jury is not going to help.
Okay.
But you can see that this remedy is for every individual. Any individual can start attacking law that way. And this is not the first time it's been done. It actually was done in the Sanger case way back when the country was first established. And what happened is there was a newspaper that there was some libel activity, or at least it was accused of being libel, and it was, Patrick Adams that defended this guy Zenger in it. And what he did is he said that in this case it was not libel, it was factual. And, of course, the prosecuting attorney and the judge says to the jury, well, you have to disregard that. You can only hear the facts of the case and disregard his presumptions here. Well, he was so convincing, the attorney was so convincing, he convinced the jury, which was the right, to do this case under the general verdict. And the general verdict, which still exists today, it is the law of the land, says that the jury has a right not only to try the facts, but also the law, and it can try the law to see if it's a good law or a bad law. Now, I'm going to tell you that you know a good law because it benefits the people. You know a bad law because it doesn't benefit the people. So I'm going to ask you a question. When a man is driving, he doesn't have a license because he doesn't have the money. He's barely making it today. He didn't pay for his license, and he's arrested, and they impound the car. Is that a good law or is that a bad law?
It's a bad one.
It's a bad one. It stole his property, didn't it? And let's say he has some mouths to feed at home. Well, I've seen this happen in court cases, and it usually happens to people of not the heritage of Americans, we'll put it that way, because they don't speak the language they're taken advantage of quite easily in this country. So this is a remedy that one can do individually to start changing the country back, and you can do it in your state, am I correct? Now, if one person did it in 1 year, it would have changed one law, basically. But imagine the people learning this and saying, well, wait a minute, how do I want to be judged? When I'm confronted with a commercial law, and let's say it's something like I wanted to build a room onto my house because I couldn't afford to pay the $15,000 for permits to add the room on. I had the money to build the room, I just didn't have the money to do the permits. So I snuck the room on. And I was found out, and I refused to tear it down, demolish it, because it was my property. I looked at it, and I said, well, wait a minute, there's my labor in here, my wealth in here, and I don't want to tear it down. And next thing I know, I'm going to jail. I've lost. Well, what if you're on that jury? Did the man actually, is the law benefiting the man or not benefiting the man? How would you decide as a juror?
Well, but that's also, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but from what I'm understanding is what's fixing to take place here in this, you know, throughout the world, is they're going to take out these kind of juries, and they're just going to have administrators, and there won't be much of a court system in that respect.
But it's still there.
Okay.
It is still there today, so we still have that as a benefit to the knowledgeable man or woman who gets on a jury. The power you wield at that point is unlimited. You don't have to convince your fellow jurors. All you have to do is say, that doesn't benefit mankind. Let me ask you, if you had 5 children and your husband lost his job and you lost your job, but you were an excellent cook and you had your house, and you were going to lose your house if you didn't make your payments, and there was no hope of another job, but you started cooking out of your house and feed people who would pay you to eat your food, and they said it's an excellent dinner that they've had, and they were paying you handsomely. Did you break any law, any of the Creator's laws?
No.
Do you have a right to support your family?
You should.
By whatever means, under any emergency, whether it's an emergency or not.
Yes.
Yeah, you do. That's what I'm talking about. That comes from the Creator. And I often say, if you put your face towards the state, you have your head, the back of your head, towards your Creator. You have to make an issue of which master you want to serve. Do you want to serve the state, who is usurping all the power of the Creator, even your talents, telling you that you don't own your occupation? And the truth is Robert Rowan is a doctor. He's a licensed doctor. However, if he does something wrong, his license, all the years of his education that he invested his money in, the state didn't invest that money in, can go and be revoked instantaneously. That means he didn't even have the right to his education if they revoke his license.
Yeah, but they're fixing to enact a 1,500-page law.
Yeah, but do you see what's happening? And
yeah.
This is what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We're telling you how they're able to do this. They're fixing to enact 1,500 pages of legislation that they haven't even read, and they can do it because they're in an unlimited jurisdiction where they can do anything they want on their boat on the sea. And they can do that to us because using their property, we're subject to it. If we're and here's another thing that's in the book, another pearl. Where in the Constitution does the Congress have the power to issue rules or regulations? Do you know where?
No.
There's only 2 places. One, Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce among the states. That's the Commerce Clause. To regulate. That includes tax, set terms and conditions for moving things back and forth between states. Commodities. There's one other place Congress gets to do it. It's Article 4. Congress shall have the power to make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territories or other properties of the United States. So if you are subject to a rule or regulation, you're either in commerce, or you are using their property, or you are their property. That's it.
Okay, so the remedy for this is what?
There are many remedies. Some of them are a little too sophisticated at this point because we don't have a great deal of people who are knowledgeable yet of what has happened in America. And that's everything from a new security going out there that's actually owned by the people, mirrored right on the Federal Reserve note. It's worked for over 80 years, the Federal Reserve note, and no one has ever questioned it. Well, people have questioned it, but most Americans accept it freely. But what if the Americans, or every citizen of every nation, were the actual owners of their own securities? And there would be no lien on those securities, and there would be no interest on those securities. What would happen then? And those securities could not replicate themselves. You know, like that gold coin. If you had a gold coin 5 years ago and you put it in a jar, it would still be one gold coin in that jar 5 years later. You put a Federal Reserve note in that jar 5 years ago And when you look at the jar today, it looks like one Federal Reserve note, but the interest on it has replicated it. It's actually reproduced itself. That's a cancer, isn't it? And the reproduction is the interest, the profit, and the gain to the Federal Reserve.
Oh, let's talk about another cancer. The Federal Reserve creates its currency out of thin air, and then it loans it. Let's say it creates $1 million out of thin air. And remember, when we talk about dollars, we're not talking about real money. We're talking about their funny money. At the end of the year, $1 million plus $5 has to come back, 5%. So $1,050,000 has to come back. Where does that $50,000 come from? More loans. Do you see the fraud? Let's talk about the fractional reserve system and the economic meltdown. If I go into the bank and I stick 100 real dollars into the bank, on a fractional reserve system, they get to loan 90. So you get the loan for 90, you go to your bank, deposit it, and that bank loans $81 to the next guy. He goes and deposits it in his bank, and they loan $73 to the next guy. My original $100 just created 800 more out of thin air that don't exist. And all you have to do is pull one of those cards in that chain down, and a bank goes insolvent, and the whole thing goes down, and that's where we are right now with this economy, in a card-crumbling meltdown.
Yeah, you know, the illusion, Melody, is so not obvious to the American people, and I'll give you an example. If you were to take $1,000 and put 10 people in a circle, and you pass that $1,000, and each one of them was a good taxpayer, and you said, this is for doing this service, and you pass that around 100 times to each one of them, got only that $1,000 each time, each of them would have to report $100,000 on their taxes.
Isn't that amazing?
Is that a sham?
Yes, it is.
That's what happens, isn't it? That sounded like it was a fantasy or an illusion I was given as an example, but that's what happens because there is not an unlimited amount of Federal Reserves out there. There's something like, how many Federal Reserves are out there right now, Robert?
Well, 4 years ago or 3 years ago on the Federal Reserve's own website, it said that the net worth of all Americans was about $65 trillion. Now, how could you have a net worth of $65 trillion when all the Federal Reserve notes that were in circulation and demand deposits together only total $2.5
trillion? What if everyone decided to sell their house on the same day and there's only $2 trillion out there and they have $65 trillion in real estate? Who's going to lose?
They're going to lose
about
a lot,
97%
too.
Of them. You see the illusion there?
Right, right.
See, with an honest monetary system, that could never happen.
How do we create our own honest monetary system?
I don't think we have enough time.
Enough time, okay.
Well, I guess we'll have to have
you back. It's a very simple process. Don't get me wrong, but there really isn't enough time right now to do it because you have to describe the benefits of it in contrast to what the Federal Reserve note has given you in return.
So we can maybe do that at another interview.
If you're so inclined to do that, we wouldn't deny it. We wouldn't deny being interviewed again.
I've got one probing question I want to toss out for a minute here. If I was to create something, say I've just got a tree in my front yard, I pull out my chainsaw, and I cut a statue, and it sits there for a few years, and then one day, Ron, you, my neighbor, you come over and you say you want to buy my statue of a bear cut out of a tree. And I say, okay. And you, in agreement, choose to give me your lawnmower. And so we just give each other receipts for the trade, and now the bear is in your yard, and I've got the lawnmower. Are these receipts that we might give one another? Under the
commerce, because in common law you never gave a receipt across. With one hand you gave the gold across, and the other hand you took the property. It's instantaneous contract.
Okay.
The thing is, in this society,
I want to alter the question then a little bit. If I just gave you the work of art, and could you give me a note? Just say you write something on a 3x5 card and say, you owe to the bearer of this card X number of hours of your labor. Can I then take that note and trade it around the town and as a commodity? Or maybe that's not the right word.
If the Federal Reserve note didn't exist, yes, you could, and you wouldn't be in commerce.
So that right there, if we just start writing notes of debt to bearer, we could get out of the Federal Reserve system, huh?
Yeah, but see, that would still, you could do that. You could do that, but you would have to eliminate the Federal Reserve system altogether, because the presumption is the stuff that you're negotiating with, transacting with, were originally purchased with Federal Reserve notes, and they all have liens on them.
So there's just no way out of it.
They
actually did try to checkmate us, but you can get out of it. Ron will explain.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you're in bankruptcy, then and you declare that you're insolvent and what is the term I want for when they are in bankruptcy.
Remember, it's the federal government that's in bankruptcy. You're not in bankruptcy. You have an unlimited source of energy until your creator pulls you.
Mm-hmm.
That's real substance, isn't it?
Yes.
And that unlimited source of energy can produce for you.
Okay, but I guess what I'm trying to say is, can you erase the debt? Because it was built on a fraud in the first place.
That's it. You hit the remedies. The real remedies is when the people clamor against their politicians and say, you recognize this or we're pulling you out of office. And I don't know how angry a mob of people can get when they realize that they have become property of a foreign corporation. I don't know how angry they're going to get as soon as they come to a critical mass and realize what has happened to them and why they have this pressure on them. Like I said, do you feel pressure on you at all times in this society?
Oh, yeah.
You feel the weight? There's no freedom. There really is no freedom. We have the illusion of freedom, but the illusion of freedom is we have hidden bars. You have the illusion of freedom to travel, providing you have a license and permission to travel. Take that license away, and it's illegal for you to travel by automobile. Illegal. You are breaking the law. And yet, does that make any sense?
No, and it almost seems like pure blackmail.
It is. And you have a talent by God to become a doctor or a talk host, and if you don't have their license, you don't have that right. That's illegal for you to do it.
And so that's how you got into this whole thing in the first place.
That's right.
And that's how I got into this, too.
That's not a right.
Because my colleagues lost the ability to do their God-given talents because the state said, you're not doing it the way we're going to give you the permission to do it.
Right.
And think about this. This is not any reflection on any moral issue or my reflection. But in my own state of California, a 14-year-old minor girl has more rights in the commercial jurisdiction to go and get an abortion to terminate her pregnancy without her parents' consent than you do as an adult to come to my office to get the breast cancer care of your choice. Doesn't something stink there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
So, and you know, And there's a whole other avenue of your background that would be interesting in another interview as well. But can we bring this to a conclusion here and set it up that we'll have you back?
Oh, yes. Please come back. This has just been fascinating, and you have so much to give to the people, and the people really need to receive this information.
Oh. Well, it would be our honor to come back. I hope that your listening audience is going to become proactive now that they've got some idea of what's really going on, because we need a core group of people who are going to help disseminate it. Then we can take our country back.
We
yeah,
hope
we'll
so, but we better get
back first.
Oh,
yeah.
Can we get your email, website?
newpeopleorder.com.
again?
And that's where they can go to get the book, is newpeopleorder.com. If they do not have a computer, they can call 866-308-6235 and press option 6 and thereby get the book by telephoning. 866-308-6235, press option 6 and order the book.
And how much is your book?
Online, at Amazon, it's $29.95. If they go to the website and they want to purchase 10 or more, it's we give a significant discount.
And as far as, well, I just want to thank you very much for, because you did this very short notice, and but I'll tell you, you had a wealth of information here, and again, I will try to get you guys back up to do another program, and I want to thank you for a very interesting evening.
And thank you for writing this book.
Thank you, Melanie. Thank you, Katie. And thank you, William. Good questions.
And for me, too.
Okay.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Good night.